We have been working through some of the epistles, those letters in the New Testament, with just kind of getting a taste of some of the different ones. Today we're venturing into an epistle that, or a letter that is included in the group of letters that are called the general epistles. When we looked at the book of Romans, a letter to the church in Rome, it was to a specific church or to a specific group of churches, possibly there in Rome. We looked at the book of Galatians. It was written to a region or an area of churches, but still had very specific concerns. So you might call that maybe a pseudo-general epistle, but not quite a full general epistle. We looked at Ephesians, and that represented one of the prison epistles, called a prison epistle because they were letters that Paul wrote while he was in prison in Rome. And just the last month, we looked at 1 Timothy, which represented one of the pastoral epistles. 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus are pastoral epistles, and they're called pastoral epistles because they're letters that Paul wrote to a minister in church, talking about church organization and how specifically how to lead the church. And so as we're sampling these, now we're moving into a couple of the letters that are in the category of the general epistles. And these are letters that are just simply written to Christians. They're not written to a specific church or a specific person. They are letters that just could be read by any Christian, and they cover a general topics on Christian living. We're going to be looking at James, and then the second half of November, we're going to be looking at 1 Peter. And something interesting, too, a little Bible trivia, but as we're growing and learning, some of you, I'd say most of you would know this, but then there's all that occasional person, you're like, I did not know that. And so it's nice to be able to share little things like that. But things like the letters that we studied, Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, those are titled Romans, Galatians, Ephesians because they're written to, that's the recipient churches, the church in Rome. So the Romans, the churches of Galatia, so that's Galatians, the church in Ephesus or the house churches there in Ephesus. So that's the Ephesians. So that's named, titled after the recipient churches. Some the pastoral epistles like 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, those are titled by the individual who is receiving the letter. So Paul wrote the letter, writing it to Timothy. The general epistles are backwards from those other ones. So you've got James, you've got 1st and 2nd Peter, 1st and 2nd, 3rd John, and Jude. And all of those letters are written, or they're titled by the author, not by the recipient, because the recipient is just Christians in general. So when Paul wrote Timothy, the name of that letter is Timothy. But when James wrote James, the title of that book is James, not the general or the churches scattered throughout as he addresses the churches in the beginning of his letter. So James is the author. What can we know about that? You know, how is that important? There are a number of different Jameses that it could have been. Without going into a whole lot of details on that, there are two that really rise to the top of the list. One is James the disciple. That was John's brother, the sons of thunder, the sons of Zebedee. And then the other possibility was James, the brother of Jesus, or half-brother, depending on how you look at that. James, the brother of Jesus, is the best fit. He is traditionally viewed as the author, and that understanding has not been contested strong enough to veer from that understanding. James, the disciple, one of the brothers of or John's brother, he was martyred too early to really be the author of the book. And so that really kind of puts a stopper on that theory. And then a lot of the other possible Jameses, they're not as plausible as accepting James, the brother of Jesus, as the author. So we're going down that road. So what do we know about James, the brother of Jesus? What does this bring to? Well, first of all, we know that at one point, he didn't believe in Jesus. He didn't believe Jesus was who he said he was. We see that in John chapter 7, verse 5. It says, for even his own brothers did not believe in him. So he came from an unbeliever's standpoint, doubting, skeptical. But that changed. And we're going to look at some of the middle part there. But let's skip all the way to the very end of his life. We know that James was one of the martyrs. He was killed for his faith in the gospel of Jesus Christ. His half-brother, the experience there, it changed, his perspective changed from being a half-brother to being Jesus the Messiah, the Christ, because he died for his faith in the gospel. And he actually became a very prominent leader in one of the main churches, the hub church there in Jerusalem. The tradition, and it's a very well accepted tradition of how James died, is that he was thrown from the top of the temple and he didn't die when he fell. And so then they stoned him. So, and that's of the martyrs, that's one of the more well accepted traditions of that's been passed down. So we know that he did die for the faith. James appeared separately in a list of people that Jesus appeared to. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul talks about who Jesus appears to. He's talking about the gospel message that Jesus died, and then he was buried. And we pick that up in verse 4, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, which is Peter, and to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. He then appeared to James, so singling him out. He was separate from the disciples, so it was a different James than the disciples, than the 12. and then to all the apostles. And then last of all, he appeared to me also, Paul talking about himself as one abnormally born. So James was a prominent leader in the church in Jerusalem. At the beginning of Paul's ministry, you know, we just read a bunch of letters from Paul that Paul had written, the letters to the Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, Timothy, all of those were written by Paul. At the very beginning of Paul's ministry, right after his conversion, he went and he stayed for 3 years in Damascus, and then we're told in the book of Galatians, Paul says, then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to get acquainted with Cephas, which is Peter, and stayed with him 15 days. I saw none of the other apostles, only James, who? The Lord's brother. So we know that the James that was in the Jerusalem church, that was in that hub church, was in fact Jesus' brother. And so we know that, and that's who that James was. So then near the end of Paul's ministry, as we have kind of reviewed this a little bit, talking about Ephesians and Timothy, that he passed through Ephesus to see the elders, or near Ephesus, to see the elders of the church of Ephesus on his way back to Jerusalem before he was arrested. And so he passes through there, goes down to Jerusalem, and we're told in Acts 21, when we arrived in Jerusalem, the brothers and sisters received us warmly. The next day, Paul, and Luke is writing this, so he's talking about we. Luke was with him at this point. The next day, Paul and the rest of us went to see who? James, and all the elders were present. So James was set aside there as a prominent leader among the elders there in the church in Jerusalem. Paul greeted them and reported in detail what God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. So the author of this letter, all this kind of putting all this together, why does all this matter? Why is it important? We know that he knew Jesus well, and he knew him on a couple of different levels. He knew him as a brother, as a half-brother, as growing up together, and all of the antics that happened. I have two sons, and boy, it's I had a sister, my wife had a brother, and it's just a different dynamic when you have, you know, a sister and a brother, but then you got boys, and they operate differently, and it's just interesting. And so just knowing that, I can only imagine the kind of relationship that James had with Jesus growing up. Lonnie's back there smiling. He knows. Lonnie, how many is four? Two? Just two brothers. Okay. I thought, yeah. So, and Kurt's back there, one of four. So, so it is. It's a different dynamic, isn't it, when you're all brothers. And they had, of course, some sisters there too, but there was definitely a handful of brothers in his family. But James also knew Jesus as the Messiah, as the Christ. There was a point where his mind was changed. He was a very active leader in the church in Jerusalem, and this is important because that church was a hub of the expansion of the gospel. So James was part of getting a chance to watch God open these doors through Peter and then through Paul as the gospel started rippling throughout what they knew as their whole world into the Roman, you know, the Gentiles, into the Roman culture and everything. And so James was a part of seeing that, but he was also a part of that because they would come back to the church in Jerusalem and seek out James, seek out the elders in that church for their advice, for help, for support as they were expanding. And so James, from that, displays a great deal of wisdom, which connects and is confirmed in with this letter. The letter from James is kind of like a New Testament book of Proverbs, written completely different, but they're both books of wisdom. And I would say practical wisdom. It's only practical because you can put it into practice, but it's not practical because it's not easy wisdom. It's not, does that make sense? The difference in the words there? It's not easy to put into practice, and practical is generally something that, we can just throw this right in here. No. It's the wisdom we're going to gain from this book in the next 6 weeks is some very, very, very tough subjects on wisdom, but nonetheless, great, great stuff. We're going to be using a topical style study through this, and so we're going to be talking about different forms of wisdom that Paul talks about. Wisdom in trials, wisdom in action, wisdom in our choices, wisdom of your tongue, wisdom of how we view other people, and wisdom of wisdom in knowing who to turn to for more wisdom. And so those are kind of our next 6 weeks looking at it. So today, let's talk about wisdom in trials. Let's get a base definition here. A trial is anything that tests me. Let's write that down. It's a base definition. A trial is anything that tests me. And this is the first topic that James brings up. I mean, just right out of the gates. Here's who I am. Here's who I'm writing to. Greetings. And then he goes right into this subject. And he starts off, he says, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds. So he starts his letter. It's just, I don't know if anyone else grabs that as just an odd introduction, an odd beginning. You know, hey, consider it pure joy when you're going through all this junk that you're going through. And it was prevalent. Persecution was prevalent in their time. We hear about people like J. Henry that deal with, you know, their life being threatened. J. Henry is in India. For some of you guys are not as familiar with some of our missionaries, J. Henry is one of our missionaries we support in India, and he's had his life threatened multiple times, and it's illegal to baptize him in certain places, so they have to go cross borders, and it's a mess. We hear about that, and we don't experience that as much here, though our form of persecution is changing quite a bit. Or people like down in Haiti, Salonique, who is face to face with witch doctors and witchcraft in the form of voodoo, which up here we're like voodoo, you know, and down there it's real, and he's facing it on a daily, weekly basis, and that kind of persecution, and the things that we go through here, I think we're going to be seeing quite a bit more, and that the persecution we receive here in America is just such an under-the-table type of persecution. You know, it's such almost a silent, just a muffling persecution. And it's becoming more and more and more. I mean, just with the recent event with the shooting there at the college. I don't know how many of you guys have heard the report of, you know, the survivors, where they reported that he asked them if they were a Christian. And if they said no, he shot them in the legs. If they said yes, he shot them in the head. But then when this story is being reported, I was reading a report about it that, I can't remember who was reporting about it, but that he had issue with organized religion. No, he had an issue with Christians. And that's how that these little twists on things, if that would have been any kind of group, if it would have been a race, if it would have been any other kind of religion, they would have said, he had an issue against this or that. It would have been a hate crime, but since it's Christianity, he just had a problem with organized religion. And so we're seeing more and more of this. And so our form of persecution, our form of that type of a trial is going to be growing. You know, this was a current topic for them, a current topic for us. It's also the main subject of 1 Peter, the book we're going to be studying in the second half of November. James says to consider it pure joy when you go through tough times, when you go through rough times. I don't know about you, but when I'm going through those type of things, I don't consider that pure joy. That's not the first thing that comes to my mind. It's not the first go-to phrase I have when I'm going through trials or testing or persecution or rough times or tough times or toxic relationships or condescending people or hurtful words or threats or false accusations or unstable situations or tumultuous circumstances or hazardous or dangerous environments. That's not my go-to word when those things are happening to go and say, I'm going to consider this pure joy. It's not what I think about afterwards. It's not what I think about during. But James says we should consider it pure joy. And he uses a very strong word here. It means all joy. Complete joy. Utter joy. When trials come our way. It's not just a happy face that we put on to hide the turmoil that's going on inside of us. It's not what James is talking about. He's not just saying, just put on a happy face. It's not just an optimistic comment by someone like myself who's a diehard optimist. You know, hey, there's a light side to this. There's a silver lining here. It's not that. In fact, when you look at James and you kind of understand his personality, James is an optimist. James is a realist. So he's not giving that kind of advice. What he's saying is that we should actually rejoice when trials come our way. Let's take that personally. Let's write that down. I should rejoice when trials come my way. Does this mean that we should be a church of masochists? People who find pleasure, a sick, twisted pleasure in being abused? An enjoyment in feeling pain? Is that what this means? It's not that we are to enjoy the pain or enjoy the trial or enjoy the hardship or persecution or the abuse. I should rejoice when trials come my way, not because of the pain is enjoyable. I'll let you write that down before we hit the next sentence. Not because the pain is enjoyable. I should rejoice when trials come my way, not because the pain is enjoyable, but because of the victory that can be experienced when the trial is over. That's where the rejoicing comes from. The joy is not in the current pain. The joy is in the anticipation. Ultimately, our suffering will end when the second coming of Christ happens. And that is a joy to look forward to. A joy that will be the end result of all this suffering, of all these trials, of all these hardships, of all these difficulties we go through. But we gain a lot during our time here on earth from trials as well. And there's a joy found in the end result of that. So trials come in two forms. And James covers these. We're going to break these out a little bit, unpack them a bit. The first one is testing. And that is external difficulties that test the perseverance of my faith. External difficulties that test the perseverance of my faith. He continues in verse 3, he says, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. It's a bold statement. So he's saying perseverance, that's steadfastness, that's fortitude, that's constancy, that's consistency, that's persistent determination, that is a heroic endurance. The writer of Hebrews says, but we do not belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed. Church, we're not supposed to be wimps spiritually. We're not of those that shrink back. We're not of those that are destroyed. But to those who have what? Is it not up on the screen? All right, you can say faith in church. All right, it's still safe to do that. To those who have what? Faith and are saved. We don't belong to those who shrink back. We have faith. And our faith is tested. And we see the perseverance of our faith. how strong my faith is, how much my faith can take, how much you can throw at me, and I'm still going to have faith in God. How much my faith can stand up against. I know you guys have heard me say this before, that a faith that can't be tested can't be. I haven't said it recently then. First service, what? What? There it was, where was it? A faith that cannot be tested cannot be trusted. I should have made that a little bulletin line there. And external difficulties will test our faith. So let's look at some of these external difficulties. I can be tested by natural circumstances. We live in a physically fallen world, a world that has sickness, it has disease, health problems, cancer. You know, and those things happen because we live in that world. I'm not, and I've shared this before, I'm not of the school of thought that accepts everything and says there's a reason for everything. Everything happens for a reason. I don't believe that. I believe there are some things that happen for a reason, no doubt. But there are some things that happen because they just happen. We live in a world that has disease. We live in a world where our bodies are falling apart. We live in a world that's a physically corrupt world because of the sin that we've allowed to happen in it. And so we have these things. They're natural circumstances. We have natural disasters in this fallen world we live in. Tornadoes, tsunamis, hurricanes, earthquakes, depending on where you live, you have different ones that are more threatening than others. But we hear about them, and they're a reality to us, and they happen, and your faith is tested. Your faith is tested when you get that report from a doctor. And your faith, it can only be in God in those times. And so it's tested, and the perseverance of your faith is tested. Natural circumstances that happen by human influence. Accidents like leaving a candle burning to come home to fire trucks and a house fire. It's an accident. No one willed that. No one wished it to happen. But nonetheless, if you're a Christian and you go through a scenario or a situation like that, your faith is being tested. It's going to happen regardless if it was a willed thing or not. Natural circumstances, falling down a flight of stairs, having a broken arm, cutting yourself with a knife in the kitchen and having to go to the doctor for stitches, just various things that happen. Change imposed by others' choices, like losing a job. We'll have that come up as a prayer request from time to time. I lost my job. I need, prayers. It might not have been anything they did. Sometimes a company is downsizing. Last guy on the totem pole. Stock market dropping. I know our first service suffered a lot a few years ago. Those people who had worked their whole life and put their retirement and they watched their retirement get cut in half when the stock market dropped, with full knowledge that in the rest of their lifetime, they're not going to watch it build back up to what it was. Who do they turn to for that? Where do you turn? God is the only place you can go. When you're a Christian and you have faith in Him, those circumstances will test that. A drunk driver, a rogue shooter on a college campus, change imposed on us by others' choices. Even our own decisions can lead to natural circumstances that can test the perseverance of our faith. I can be tested by supernatural influences as well. So we can have natural situations, but we can also have supernatural influences. God can let me be tested. The story of Job comes to mind. Many of us are familiar with the story of Job, where Satan goes into God's presence and they're talking and God brags about Job. Hey, have you seen my servant Job? Man, he is something. He's amazing. He's outstanding. And Satan's like, you take away his stuff and he'll curse your name for sure. God's like, all right, take it away. Just don't harm him. Gave him limitations. And so God said, I'm going to let you. So Job was tested on a supernatural level because God let it happen. So sometimes God will let that happen. And that's in this category here, not this category over here, not just because things happen. I think that happens. But then there are other things, I think, specifically that are God allowing things to happen to us. And for whatever reasons, You know, with Job's, it had nothing to do with Job other than Job was just an awesome guy. It was a conversation between God and Satan that sparked all the events that happened in Job's life. Then there's another category over here. So we've got this where God lets things happen, but then we've got this very specific category where God himself will put us to the test. I'm reminded of the story of Abraham and Isaac, where Abraham is waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for this promised son, the son that's going to provide for them the offspring that's going to number as many as the stars in the sky and the sand and the seashore. And God finally gives them Isaac. And then after a while, he gets to spend time with his son and teach him how to walk and talk and whatever games they played back then and watch him grow. And then God says, I want you to take him and sacrifice him. We know Isaac was old enough to carry wood and walk on his own, so he wasn't just a little guy. This wasn't just a few days. And Abraham goes up the mountain with Isaac. Many of us know the story. God didn't allow it to happen. He stopped him. But it was a test of his faith. And it was very, very clear that it was God himself that was testing Abraham's faith with that. So sometimes that'll happen to us. God himself will put me to the test. The testing of my faith and perseverance is necessary for my growth as a Christian. In the passage we just read, he says, let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. This is why we consider it pure joy. This is why we can read that second verse there in James and say, okay, I get it. We're to consider it pure joy when we face trials of many kinds, as James says. Because this testing that happens, these external difficulties, they test the perseverance of my faith, and that leads me to a better me. That leads you to a better you. That leads us more to be like Christ when we come out on the victory side of that, when we come out on the faith-based side of that, when our faith is tested and it's proven, then we grow more. And that's why we can rejoice when the trials come, because we know that that is a viable outcome of what this can end up as. One step closer to being like Christ. One step more mature in my walk. James says down in verse 12, he said, blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. So the first form of trials is through testing. That is an external difficulty that tests the perseverance of our faith. The second form of trials is temptation. And that is internal struggles that test the perseverance of my resolve. How bad do you want it? How dedicated are you? How much are you going to stick to it? It tests the perseverance of our resolve, these internal struggles. James turns to this, and he actually uses the same word for test and tempt, which can get a little confusing. You have to use context to understand when that word's being used for test or tempt. Just a little tidbit there. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire. Say, own evil desire. Turn to your neighbor and say, your own evil desire. It's not as easy. Some of you guys are sitting beside your spouse. You have to go home with them and eat lunch. Or you can turn to your neighbor and say, my own evil desire. Because that's where we need to get to anyway. We need to own this. We need to take ownership of this. My own evil desire. They're dragged away and enticed. So let's write this down. I am responsible for my own temptations. I'm responsible for my own temptations. Not God. You can't say God's tempting you. In fact, when we go down and we break down James's theology, James's understanding of what temptation is, you can't blame God. You can't blame others. You can't even blame Satan. I had a friend in college that everything was either God's fault or Satan's fault. Satan made me do it, man. Satan made me do it. I listened to him. Satan made me do it. And then everything, you know, of course, everything positive. You know, God made me do it. God made me do it. You know, but it's always one or the other. There was no, he's grown since then quite a bit. Very successful minister. Great guy. But that was kind of funny because that was his go-to. It was one or the other. Satan made him do it or God made him do it. I'm responsible for my own temptations. It's not God, not others, not even Satan. We need to own it. Back in the very, very first sin, Adam and Eve in the garden, when God confronted Adam about it, what did Adam do? What did he say? That woman you gave me. So he blames the woman and he blames God. That woman you gave me. That woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit from the tree and I ate it. So then God turned, he's going to deal with that in a little bit, but then he turns to Eve. He's like, why have you done such a thing? Or what is this that you have done? That Satan, that serpent, she passes the buck too. That serpent made me do it. Passing the buck is as old as the original sin, as the very first sin. People have been passing the buck and dodging we try to push the blame off. And every one of us do it. That's why it's funny, because we know it's true. We know we've done that. We've passed the buck. Well, I did this because that person did this, or because that person did that. You know, my boy is 7 and 9. There's always something. He made me. No, he didn't. That was your choice. I don't know how often I'm teaching that. Eve owned her own decision. It wasn't Satan who tempted her. Did Satan have a conversation with her? Yes. Was the goal of Satan's conversation with her to cause her to doubt God's words, to twist God's words, to make decisions based on those feelings? That was his desire. That was his goal. But it was her own desire that enticed her and led her to sin. And Adam really owned his own decision. I believe the Eagles capture the thought pretty good when they said, I found out a long time ago what a woman can do to your soul. Ah, but she can't take you anywhere you don't already know how to go. He should own it. She wasn't doing anything special there. Did Eve go to Adam and give him the fruit? Did she place in his hand the fruit of knowledge of good and evil? Yes. Did she tempt him? She put it in his hand. It was his own desire that snared him. That's where the temptation came from. So I guarantee you can put a lot of things in my hand and tell me to eat it, and I won't eat it. You can put a bowl of Brussels sprouts in my hand, and you can go on and on about how healthy it is, how good it is for you, how you'll grow up big and strong, how it does it. And I will not take a bite. You can put it in my hand. That doesn't mean I'm going to eat it. It has to be desirable to me. It has to be enticing. And that's me. That's my part. I own that. If Adam had not desired to eat of the fruit, then it wouldn't have mattered what she put in his hand. I'm sure it didn't hurt coming from a naked woman that was probably the most perfect as they come. But still, it was his own desire. It was his own desire that tempted him. Because you put a big bowl of Rocky Road ice cream in my hand, and you can tell me how dangerous that is to eat, how fattening it is, how many calories, how many carbs, and by the time you get to that point, somewhere before that, all I'm hearing is blah, 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 and the spoon's in my mouth by the time you get to the second sentence. Why? Because it's desirable to me. We have to own that. We have to own that. My own evil desire, that drags me away. That entices me. James here goes field and stream in his illustration. He's using a fishing reference to be carried off, to be drawn out, because they were enticed or lured. So that's what you do when you go fishing. How many fishermen, fisherwomen, fisher people? No fisher people in this audience. Okay, a couple back there. And that's the goal, pointing fingers over this way. That's the goal. You lure them, you entice them to bite the hook. How astonished would we be? Well, let's write this down first so you have a chance to write down. My own, say my own. My own evil desire is that which draws me and snares me. We're enticed and we're drug out. It is both the bait and the trap. We are lured in and pierced by the barbed hook. How astonished would we be? How astonishing would it be to see this scenario and have a fish sitting up on the shore with a little, you know, cup of dirt and worms and a hook, and get the worm on the hook just right, and this little fish drop it in the water, and then run around and jump in the water, and then go bite the worm on the hook that he just baited, and wait for the fisherman to pull him out of the water. It just seems like something you'd see in a cartoon, because it's so unrealistic, but this is the exact picture that James is painting. This is what we do to ourselves. We bait our own hook, and then we bite it. Your own evil desire, my own evil desire. This is the picture he's painting. Then James switches illustrations in midstream. See what I did there? Yeah. He switches the illustration to conception and birth. He says, then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to what? Death. So now sin is personified, or my own evil desire, rather, is personified as a mother. A mother who conceives and gives birth to sin, and that sin causes death. Some people try and make this out to be more than what it is. They turn it into an allegory. It's just an illustration, something in the simplicity of what James is saying. Is you don't want to mess with sin. You don't want to underestimate it. Sin is not something to be toyed with. It is deadly. You don't want to mess around with it. The wage of sin is death. That's the deal. That's what we're dealing with here. Sin is not to be trivialized. It's not something to play with. It's not something to be toyed with. It is serious business. It leads to death. And that's the truth. So how in the world are we to consider it pure joy when we're coming face to face with a temptation that when that conceives, it gives birth to sin, and sin gives birth to death? How are we to look at that and say, this is pure joy when I'm tempted with this or that? How can we count that kind of trial? Because certainly none of us should find temptation or being tempted or falling into temptation a joy at all. Once again, as it was with the external difficulties, it is with the internal struggles. It's not the moment that we are to enjoy, but it's what that can lead to. It's the anticipation. When we don't take the bait, how's that going to end? When we aren't snared and trapped, when we aren't carried off out of the water, when we do not let our evil desire conceive, then there is no birth to sin, and then there's no death in that moment. And in that moment, we have proven the resolve of our desire to stay true to our God. And that's where you find a place to rejoice. That's where you find the joy. Our character has grown in likeness to Jesus through that kind of trial, through temptation. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15, second half of that verse is that Jesus was tempted in every way, just as we are. Yet he did not sin. So those moments when you're faced with a temptation, and I love James's psychology here. It's very athletic. So those of us who have been involved in athletics, it's very much of a visualization type of athletics, is that when that challenge comes up, whether it's an external struggle or it's an internal struggle, whether it's a testing of something circumstantial or it's a testing of a temptation, when that happens, your mindset is already on the victory, not on the struggle. Does that make sense? Is that not awesome? That's how he can say, consider it pure joy, because you've already won the victory in your head. And anybody that's been an athlete, you picture it, you visualize it, and you've already scored that point. You've already won that match. You've already gotten that advancement. That's already taken place as soon as the confrontation happens. And that's what makes a good athlete, and that's what makes a good Christian. Taking this wonderful advice from James, this wonderful wisdom, that when those times come, immediately in your head, you've gotten the victory, and there's confidence. Because otherwise, if you're not there, when that moment comes, you're going, oh no, what am I going to do? Or I hope I'm strong enough. If you take James's advice, it's none of that. It's victory. Let's get through this and win the victory. Because I already see it now. I'm rejoicing. When I am victorious, I get to witness that I'm going to be more like Jesus, who did not sin when he was tempted. This is something to look forward to. James says in chapter 5, he says, be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near.